Descent into Hell by Charles Williams, who's one of the lesser-known Inklings, is a book that Peter Kraft described as the most terrifying book that he has ever read. Part of the terror comes from Williams' bold exploration of time as a cosmic instrument, like space, for salvation. He describes a scene in which a woman feels prompted to cry out in prayer on behalf of someone else's pain. Now, 400 years before, a man burning in agony on a pyre cries out for relief. Jane's question, Charles' question in her chapter of our Why We Create series, which deals with time, her question is that both of these cries for God hang in eternity. So what do we call that thing in eternity, which we can't really call a moment in which his cry meets her intercession? In other words, what exactly does it mean to live as a time-bound human as if in Christ we are being brought into eternity? The Anselm Society's focus in the month of June is a theology of time. And in fact, the question of what to do with the time that is given to us will be the theme of our Imagination Redeemed conference at the end of September. Depending on exactly when we release this episode, tickets will either be on sale or be about to be on sale for that. So head over to imaginationredeemed.com to sign up. We also have an art gallery in the works. To learn more about that and submit your work for consideration, head over to anselmsociety.org. Last year, we had over 70 submissions and a wonderful jury process to pick a beautiful themed gallery. So today, getting back to the subject of time, today my guest is Ned Bustard, and as part of the Anselm Society's June focus on a theology of time, we're going to explore that question that Charles Williams raised, the question of our relationship to time and to eternity. And we're going to do it through the lens of time travel stories, and particularly Doctor Who. A little background, though. Ned is a visual artist and graphic designer who's done work for World's End Images, Christians in the Visual Arts, SIVA, and perhaps most recognizably to the Anselm audience, he illustrated Douglas McKelvey's prayers in Every Moment Holy. He's also a children's book illustrator, author, and printmaker. And some of the books that he's written, illustrated, or edited include It Was Good, Making Art to the Glory of God, The Chronicles of Narnia Comprehension Guide, Revealed, a Storybook Bible for Grownups, and most relevant to our conversation today, Bigger on the Inside, Christianity and Doctor Who. He's an elder at Wheatland Presbyterian Church and creative director for Square Halo Books. Now that I've monologued for 2 minutes, Ned, welcome to the show.
That's just beautiful. Well, it's great to be here. I was thinking as you're talking about these tickets going on sale, from God's perspective, they're on sale already. They are on sale. They've been on sale. They will be on sale. The tickets are available, and we hope everyone comes.
So, all right, let's just start with backstory. Tell me about your interest in time travel stories.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think growing up, I was always into superheroes and all that kind of stuff. But in my teens, I stumbled upon Doctor Who. It was usually late at night on the public broadcasting channel. My first doctor was John Pertwee, and he had his ruffled ascot or little tuxedo suit that he was running around, had a car that I think actually said Doctor Who on it or something. But what was interesting at that time, everybody was really excited about Tom Baker, and he's the one that, if you know Doctor Who, he's got the long scarf, and so that was who everyone was interested in. But that he was not my first doctor. Pertwee was my first doctor, though. I had my grandmother knit me a scarf that was, you know, 8 feet long and multicolored and everything. And, you know, everyone who knew me had no idea why I had such a crazy long scarf, because that's one of those things you keep on the down low, that you like time travel, Doctor Who, and, you know, being a nerd was not popular back then. You know, this is in the late 70s, early 80s. But I discovered Doctor Who and just found it captivating. Our family were Anglophiles, so here we've got England plus time travel plus... Well, then you've got Peter Davidson with his cool cricket jacket and celery on his lapel. And I was just enraptured. I loved, I guess, the exercise of playing with what is time and how does that work? Oh, and some of it comes early on. First grade, I was first introduced to the Chronicles of Narnia. And it has been my obsession my whole life. If there's one, you know, if you have to go to Desert Island, I'm taking the Chronicles of Narnia. And in that, you've got a lot of talk about time, because, you know, the Pevensies, they go to Narnia, they come back, and no time has passed at all. Then in Prince Caspian, thousands of years have passed. And I just love that. I just love the whole thinking about that. At that point, I was too young to really think that time affected me. You know, I'm a fish. I'm swimming in water. I'm not thinking about wetness means. Now, as I'm getting older, I'm able to step back and be more abstract in my thought. And it only gets me more excited. And the Doctor Who book kind of came from me jumping back into the world of Doctor Who. I set it aside. And, you know, the world set it aside. And then it was rebooted with Eccleston and then David Tennant and Matt Smith. And that was when I came back into it and realized, and the point of the book was, I realized that they're dealing with these major ideas, good and evil. Doctor Who just has so much that they're working with that it naturally leads into questions of ultimate reality. And I feel like so many episodes of Doctor Who really are basically just examples for sermons that just haven't been used yet. Like, this is a great way, this would be a great way to sum up. And that's when I collected all the writers for this book. Initially, I said, imagine that this is just, you know, that one story that the pastor is going to tell to illustrate that one idea that he's really trying to get you a hold of, and realize that Doctor Who has done that in so many ways.
So what did you feel was the result in the book? So for someone who hasn't read the book, each chapter deals with one kind of big idea as a result.
Yeah, one major concept, like my chapter is on prayer. And each chapter so has a big idea that's dealing with, but it does it through the lens of a particular episode. I think one of the chapters might deal with a couple episodes because there's like a story arc. But mostly it's one episode and you talk about Doctor Who, and then you're in the middle of it and you say, oh, wait, this really kind of helps me understand prayer better or evil better, or, you know, and each of the writers has different topics that they've latched onto. And ultimately, hopefully, this book will sell out and I'll do a second edition. It'll be bigger than the first one and we'll have more because there's just so much fodder there for us to work through.
There is. And I think it was smart of you to do an episode as a point of focus for each chapter, because I should say, for those of our listeners who have maybe tried out Doctor Who and it hasn't really stuck, Doctor Who's just one of those shows, because it's lasted on and off as long as it has, and had so many writers and so many actors. It's this fascinating, unusual show that is only as good as the writers currently telling the
right,
story.
Exactly.
So you have these stretches of the show, long stretches of the show sometimes, that are just silly. And you have seasons that contain individual episodes that are absolutely stunning sci-fi. Just really, really, really good. And yeah, sometimes you'll have that stunning, that great episode, and then the one after it will be a different writer, and it's just bad silly.
Painful.
There's good silly and there's bad silly, yeah. And sometimes it's just bad silly.
Well, and some of the ideas are just horrible. And then for those who might be older, remember the 1970s or 80s Doctor Who. I mean, it's classic for how bad the special effects are. And you've just got these, you know, men in rubber suits walking around, and it just looks ridiculous. You know, I think about the body of work of the Beatles. They've got tons and tons of songs. Is everyone a good song? No. I mean, I'm sure there are faithful that would say, yes, every single Beatles song is the highest good. Probably not. You know, there are the best, and Doctor Who has been around long enough that it's had so many bad ones that there are plenty of good ones that you can point to.
Yeah. And then I would say, as the years have gone on more recently, you have, I don't know where the sci-fi writers went, but I think they've hired sort of standard political writers more than sci-fi writers.
Oh my goodness.
So all of a sudden.
Yeah, don't even get me started. I'm going to step down on that soapbox. But yes, I agree.
We can pretend some recent doctors didn't exist.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, poor Peter Capaldi. Those seasons would have been so good in the hands
of a better
writer.
Peter could have been the most perfect Doctor Who ever. I was so excited when he came on, and he was so excited. And towards the end, it just makes me sad. It makes me sad.
Yeah. So let's back off Doctor Who for just a second. And I mean, there's so many different stories that have dealt with time travel in such fascinating ways. And sometimes very different interpretations. Like, you've got the classic kind of Back to the Future one. You mess with something here and you create an alternate time stream. And Marvel DC are now messing around with it. And I mean, I quit watching The Flash after they created an alternate timeline.
Oh, yeah.
Like, wow, I have to now stop caring about everything that happened for the last two seasons because you're just erasing it.
And yeah.
Like, why?
Because you're a lazy writer. That's what you ran out of good ideas. I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. But talk to me about, like, as you've seen different stories with time travel, because I think it was Christian Leithart's essay in the Doctor Who book talks about it's relatively recent in human history that time has become as much of an abstract topic to think about, something to be sort of existential about. You don't see as much of that prior to, you know, some point in modernity. And then all of a sudden we're scheduling based on hours, right? I'll meet you at 8 o'clock and you at 9 o'clock. And that's totally unheard of. That's totally unheard of almost in some cultures now, let alone time ago. But then you also have this layer of just time travel stories as a thing. And there's really creative, really interesting time travel stories that make you think differently about something, about how you engage with time. And then there's ones that are just, you know, more implausible or more silly and don't make you think as much. Can you think of some examples of time travel stories that, or time travel motifs, ways of handling time travel that have particularly impressed you?
I don't know. I'm impressed. Well, yeah, you have Star Trek. They did that too. They went back in time. Yeah, there's a lot of folks who have dealt with it. I think that, I guess because of my age, Back to the Future really locked in my brain a lot of the rules of time travel. Mm-hmm. But then you start talking about it and you're like, why does that make sense? And these other ones don't, you know, or there's the butterfly effect. You know, you go back and you take one butterfly, kill one butterfly, and then everything goes to hell, or you have an alternate reality.
Right, which I think Doctor Who deals with at some point in the last decade, something like, oh, you've heard of the butterfly effect. Yeah, that's silly. It doesn't. You can do things that screw up the course of history, but you have to really do something big.
Yeah, yeah. I struggle with it. I don't know if I have an answer for specific ones that I think are good. I think for me, it's more about, I think Leithart's talking about the fact that we're sensitive to this is a great thing, because we do have the luxury to think about time in ways that people didn't before. And as an example of what you're saying about even now and culturally, I bill by the hour. Everything's in quarter hour increments in my brain, which I think is an unhealthy way to view time, but that's how I function with time. I had a friend who was a missionary, and he lived in, I want to say Kenya, but someone would come and say, I'm going to go visit my brother. Do you want to come with me? And that turned out to be a 3-day walk both ways. And you realize here I'm dealing with time in a completely different way than this, than my brother in Africa. Same thing. You know, we were using the same resource, but in either healthy or very unhealthy ways. That doesn't go to your question at all. So
no,
we need to circle back.
Well, what you are getting at, though, is, bringing a theological dimension into it, we have conflicting experiences of time, right? We've all used phrases like time moves so quickly or time moves so slowly.
Right.
And
there's a New York minute, which is different from the minute that I'm having right now.
Yeah. And there's, how fast your kids' childhoods go, and there's how slow that the one day with the kid goes.
Right.
It's crawling and, oh, I wish they would just go to bed. And there's, children, they're playing in the sandbox for hours and no conception of time passing. And, people getting ready to go somewhere.
There are those parts of our family.
Need to get to church. But there are, there are three Greek terms that are used, named after three Greek gods of time that deal with some of that. You have chronos, which is where we get our word chronological, right? Time progressing, moments on a clock, measurable, right? Predictable. And that's primarily how, certainly, we tend to consciously think about it. And it's the conveyor belt that we've been dealt with. But then you also have another word, kairos, which is more about meaning, more about, it's not measurable by clocks. Jane Shaw writes about this in her essay. It's more about right time or appropriate time or meaning within time. It's God's time. It's, when the meaning of time itself becomes clear, is how Jane phrased it.
When Christ came at the fullness of time, it was a time, but that's not what they're talking about. They're talking when it was appropriate, when things had gotten to the point that it was time for Christ to come.
Mm-hmm. And that's the word in scripture that the verse is about, there is a time to be born and a time to, that's not chronos, that's kairos.
Yeah.
There is an appropriate moment for this. And then you have the last one that we really don't talk about much is ion, which is where we get the word eon, which is eternity itself. So basically you have chronology, which is this created thing. We live in a material world, space, which is a created thing.
Finite, limited thing
yeah. that God has made for us. And then similarly, we have chronos, time, which is this finite, created, limited thing that God's given to us. Then you have God's thing over here that we can't begin to comprehend. And then Kairos is the meeting point of the two. Yeah. So the great, as you pointed out, the great moment of it is the incarnation, which then has ripple effects and ramifications for the life of the church. Because a lot of our instinctive question as humans is always how to transcend time, not necessarily in a time travel sense, but in the sense of, I want my life to matter. I want, yeah. right? And for the Greeks, that was fame and being remembered. And there's different cultures that have had different ways of engaging with it. Hannah Arendt wrote about this a lot, different cultures, conceptions of what it meant for your life to mean something. But we all want our lives to
Well, and you have presidents something. Are always talking about, what's my legacy? Mm-hmm. They want to know how time, their time, will have mattered.
Yeah. So what does it mean for my chronos to meet Aeon in Kairos? And that's where I think time travel stories can move from the realm of just sort of fun and interesting to actually, this is not the word I'm looking for, but useful, challenging.
Well, it's making you stop and really look at this experience of time in ways that just going to store every day doesn't do that. And I think that we as believers, and that's one of the great things I love about Francis Schaeffer. He talks about Christ coming in time and space. That is this great hinge. And when you say, oh, I can orient myself to something, well, in Doctor Who, they talk about fixed point in time. That's a fixed point in time. You can't mess with that. It has changed reality in ways, you know. Well, Christian Lightheart says that God has entered time. He's part of time now, even though he exists in eternity. And those are just amazing things to think about. And how do we orient ourselves to that? Because that's what you know, there's basically, when you talk about a time stream, you know, there's a rock that's been dropped in the middle of time stream. The ripples are going out. You have to deal with that. You can't say, well, that didn't exist, because you're seeing the effects of it through time and space.
Yeah. And
I wasn't going anywhere with that. It's just, those ideas are just so massive to me that I can't get around them.
Well, that's one of the reasons I love Doctor Who, because with Back to the Future, it's straightforward, right? They even have the decency to have Doc Brown draw it out on a chalkboard for
right,
you.
Right, for those who can't follow where we're going with this.
Yeah. To make the whole rest of the story easy to follow. And, you know, one of the best remembered lines in Doctor Who was during David Tennant's tenure, when he has this, I had to write this down to make sure I got it exactly right, but he says, people assume that time is a strict progression from cause to effect, but actually from a non-linear, non-subjective viewpoint, it's more like a big ball of wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey stuff.
Stuff. I kind of lost it myself there, is what he says after that point. And for the listener who doesn't like Doctor Who, that episode is Blink, and it's probably one of the better episodes to jump in on if you know nothing about Doctor Who.
Yeah, I introduced my sister-in-law to Doctor Who with that episode.
Yeah, I mean, I like to use the Girl in the Fireplace, and that's the one my chapter is about. But yeah, the Blink one is just so good. I'm sorry, I just derailed you.
No, that's okay. Because you mentioned Girl in the Fireplace. So what I like about that line, we'll get back to Girl in the Fireplace, is even
the wibbly wobbly timey wimey.
Yeah, the wibbly wobbly thing is, on some level, it's just sort of silly, but they're getting at this time thing is more complicated than the Back to the Future portrayal. It's more complicated than you realize.
You said a little few minutes ago, the conveyor belt. And right. I think that's where Henry Ford has got us thinking conveyor belt.
Yeah.
Yeah. I put the object here, it goes down, it gets changed, and I could go back earlier in the conveyor belt and mess things. But yeah, Doctor Who's saying, you don't even have a clue. You're not even close to what time is.
Yeah. And the fun thing about that, and I owe Jane a debt of gratitude for doing the heavy lifting on this in her chapter, she talks about Carlos Rovelli, who is a theoretical physicist still working, and he's one of the founders of loop quantum gravity theory. I don't know what that means.
It sounds cool, right? Really cool. And I'm sure McCoy could tell you all about that, or Kirk or Spock. They've got that all. That's like basic 101 Starfleet right. Academy stuff.
Yep. But he's the science version of that funny line. He basically says, yeah, the linear flowing step-by-step experience that we have of time is nothing like how time actually works, even with the limited knowledge we have of how time actually works. In a similar way that if you study light, right? Like beams of light coming into your house from the sun, like, oh, that's light. Or maybe light is the way that it lights something up. Well, then you start getting into the particles that make up light, and you start getting into the way that the color red is translated to your brain, and you realize everything that I think I know about light, at least scientifically speaking, is completely wrong. And
oh, yeah. And just the way it functions. I mean, talking about time.
Yeah.
I have a friend who's a physics professor, and he tried to explain this to me when I couldn't understand it, but just how it moves differently. Well, how can you have that? Because we have, I have 60 seconds in this minute. And he's like, no, you really don't. Or you have lots more than that. It's all over the place.
But this is where stories get interesting and get good, because you have, from a scientific standpoint, the last 3 minutes of our conversation just make my head hurt. And I could probably study it much more than I have, and it would still make my head hurt. But a story from a really creative storyteller can kind of punch you outside those assumptions about the nature of reality. And we need that, because the challenge of being human is that we straddle the physical and spiritual worlds.
Right.
We are not bodies that will become a soul someday. We're like none of this, right? We are embodied souls, or pick your favorite term for the fact that we are both a body and a soul. We are in the material world, and we are made for a future which will also be material, but in which the material and the spiritual that it is designed to help us encounter in a limited way will be united. We will not be disembodied souls on clouds someday, which means, if we think about the already and the not yet of the church, the fact that Christ has come and Christ will come again, and we're in this moment where Kairos, the ultimate Kairos, has happened. Eternity has entered into time, and there's still a future that we're looking forward to. Everything about Christianity is concerned with this ultimate question of, what does it look like to live now? What does it look like to be the church now? Who am I supposed to be as a person, or as a part of the body of Christ, in a world where Christ has come but has not come back? And time travel stories can push us outside of that chronological headspace and help us to, even if we don't fully understand something differently, it at least expands our minds to the potential that there's more than the way that I see
you
it.
You think about it just from a sanctification standpoint.
Okay.
You say, I'm told, you know, my pastor tells me that God sees me as perfect. You know, that I'm completed in Christ. I'm wrapped in his. Well, how is that possible? I'm dealing with these aspects of me that's not. Well, he knows the end of the story. I am with him. You know, I don't see this, but I am with him currently, time-wise, outside of that, in the new creation. I am part of that now, except I'm not, because I'm stuck in this time period.
Right. We experience it as there's a line, there's a conveyor belt, and I am at this spot on the line, and there I can look back at what's already happened on the line, and I can dream or worry about the future on the line. But to God, he's like at the end of the line, looking down the whole line as a cohesive
thing. It's a thing. It's done. Yeah. It's a done deal. That's what I love about the episode in Doctor Who of The Girl in the Fireplace.
Yeah, talk about that. And you may want to start by briefly summarizing the
plot. Yeah, that, and this is the episode that I deal with in my chapter, and I'm talking about prayer, but it all hinges on this idea. So Doctor Who is a time traveler in time and space. So he lands his ship, which is a blue police box, in a ship that's out in space. And he lands and he realizes that the whole ship is empty, he thinks, but he walks around this ship, and they show you clips of the ship actually at times, and it actually is a very long ship, kind of cigar length or shape a little bit. So you definitely get this idea of linearness. But you're walking around, and periodically through the spaceship, there are windows, and these windows are looking into France in the time of, who is it, Louis the 16th maybe? But they're all different points, and you start figuring out that they're all windows into the life of one girl, and or one woman. It's Madame de Pompadour. And the access point is, the story is called The Girl in the Fireplace. The doctor is looking through a fireplace, and he sees a little girl. And it turns out this fireplace is a portal, a window that you can step through into a specific point in time. So he looks and talks to this girl, and she's 8 years old. And then He goes through, spins back, goes back in the spaceship, comes back in a couple minutes later, and now she's a teenager. And then he realizes the rest of the spaceship has these portals, and they're all at different points of time in this one woman's life. And at one point, she's calling out for help. She's like, "Doctor, you have to help me." He tells her, in her life, years before, "I am going to help you, and don't worry, I'll be there," because he knows he's there, because he's got all these windows into her life, and he keeps stepping through. He is outside of her time and looking at her whole life as one. And she talks about in the episode, "I have to take the slow path, but you can flip through my life like pages in a book." And she understands how the doctor is dealing with that.
And the book is a great example too, because when you think about a book, you know, you say, "Oh, I really love Brideshead Revisited."
Yep.
You don't say, "I love page 43 of Brideshead Revisited." It's a cohesive whole.
And you can jump in at any point in that story. And, you know, that's something, as I said, I love Narnia. I love jumping in at different points in it. The story's done. I know what happens in the last battle, but I can go back and experience the Voyage of the Dawn Treader as if it's happening for the first time. And this is the joy of literature. But it's also the joy or the reality that we have as time, partakers of time, people who are in time. But if you think that God is outside of time, that's where it gets trippy. But I think that that's where stories like Doctor Who and time travel can help us, because it says, okay, this time thing is a finite, it's got beginning and end, and there's at least one person who can look at this from the outside and not be limited by our sequentialness.
Yeah. And the fun thing about, so it was like that episode is, it's almost like the writer asked, in this whole situation where Narnia and our world have different time, what would it like to be Aslan in that scenario?
Exactly.
And so you're looking at it through the lens of Doctor who is not Aslan. He's not a god figure. He's still limited in different ways. But you do get to see it from his point of view. The story's not told from Madame de Pompadour's point of view.
Not at all.
It's told from Doctor Who's point of view.
Actually, from her perspective, we learn her story out of sequence in the episode.
Yeah. So the great thing about it, I think, is that, and this is one of the great things about Doctor Who, is that because you are looking at all of these time travel stories from the lens of the point of view of the time traveler. And the person for whom time traveler is a way of life, right? As opposed to Marty McFly, "Oops, something happened to me."
Right.
You're able, I think, to bring this question to the stories, which is, what is the importance of the present if past and future aren't what I think they are?
Yeah. Well, I think it certainly adds gravity to the present when we start thinking about that. Wow, that question was so big, I can't even get my head around it. Why don't we try that again?
Yeah.
So, or that concept.
Yeah. So, what is the importance of the present if past and future aren't what I think they are? If it's not a conveyor belt, if it's more complicated than that, and much like, you know, the bush outside the window, it's something that I can learn to understand better than I do, but it's also connected to a larger reality that I'm not ready for.
Right. Well, and
what does that mean for the present?
It informs the, well, I think, you know, as we experience Sunday school, I mean, reading scripture, that is past, present, that is informing my current experience. The fact that God interacted with Moses on the mountain, the fact that he took people and said, "I have a plan for you, and it's a glorious plan, but you're going to screw this plan up as well." That makes you realize that you are connected, and that, well, for one thing, the crisis that you're experiencing right now is not as big as you would think it would be, because it is connected to a larger story. You know, we are minor characters probably at best in that story, and just with our walk on bits. So I think that that's where you realize that you have to connect yourself to the past and future. And if you don't, well, I think that you see this a lot in just our neighbors who don't have the concept of the finished work of Christ. They don't have the concept of new creation. If present is all there is, then it skews reality in so many ways. I mean, I think you see this in, I mean, not just time travel, but just stories on TV. You see someone act in a rash way, and you're like, I know what happened at the beginning of this episode, and I know that we've got three more episodes after this. What you just did was a very foolish thing. You shouldn't have done that. But you weren't thinking of your life in part of that whole episode or the whole season. You were just thinking about your episode. I mean, C.S. Lewis talks about this with Screwtape letters. We just need to keep the patient, you know, the Screwtape is the demon. We need to keep him thinking that this is all there is. And there will never be relief. There's never hope of overcoming this sin. I just have to sin right now. And that is a gift of time travel stories, that it helps you say, yeah, it's hard right now, but this is only a sliver of the big story that's going on right now. And you need to live in the future of who you are going to be. I mean, you know, we're called to that, that be who God says you are, not who you think you are. I have a piece of artwork called Simul Ustis et Peccator, and it's the Latin, simultaneously sinful and saved or something. I'm not a Latin expert, but that, and it's a depiction of a person looking in a mirror, and in the mirror, the person sees himself as bound and in chains. But then we look at the picture and we see that he's looking at himself in his reflection. He sees himself bound and in chains, but he's actually clothed in the clothes of Christ. He's clothed in Christ's righteousness. That is his reality. His reality is he is, has been made perfect in Christ. He's looking at himself in the mirror and he says, I'm a sinful person and I'm just bound and trapped in my sin. And we say, brother, look, you have been made holy in Christ, and this is your reality. It's a future reality, but it's a current reality at the same time. And you're just focusing on the present, and that is not reality. You think it's reality because it's the only thing that you can experience. It's like we think time is all there is. Like, well, I have to, it's going to be 60 seconds. There's nothing else I can do about it. Like, no, actually, it's a much bigger game, and you need to play it that way.
That's really well said. And not only can we blow the present out of proportion, either through not believing there is an eternity mm-hmm. or through forgetting that there is an eternity,
right.
We can do the same thing with the others. I mean, one of the things that Jane points out in her essay is that the biggest distractions from the human work of love are past perceived wrongs.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And
I can't forgive you, so therefore I can't love you right now.
Or loss, yeah. Or losses. This is like something, some kind of trauma from the past, and future abstractions, right? Worries about where things are going. And yet you, just as you cannot grapple adequately with the past or the future if you believe that essentially there only is the present, you also can't live adequately in the present without a fuller understanding of past and future, in which this progression, you know, your past doesn't define you. What's going to happen tomorrow doesn't, I mean, this is very biblical. What's going to happen tomorrow shouldn't ruin today.
Don't worry about the worries about tomorrow. Christ talks about that.
Yeah. And I love the way that Jane phrases it. She says, the devil has managed to turn time into a double-edged sword, slicing at us with nostalgia or regret over the past and poisoning us with dread or abstract ambitions about the future, and distracting us entirely from the present, from Kairos, our nearest analogy to the experience of eternity. But salvation is nothing less than a union with God, so perfect that we recognize all the moments of our lives as gifts of grace, of opportunities to be with God.
Yeah, in the present. And that sounds very similar to what C.S. Lewis talks about in Screwtape Letters, where Screwtape says, make sure that you get the patient, the Christian, to not think about the present. Whatever you do, let them live in the past or worry about the future, but that actually present is where their experience of eternity is happening. And we want to keep them from thinking that. Like, we are right now in this present, as you and I are talking, we are in eternity. This is where it's touching. And what are you going to do about that? And if you obsess and you live in the past, then you've lost the present and you've lost your touch to eternity and you've been rendered powerless to really do the good work of loving your neighbor and loving your God.
Yeah, and going back to your chapter on prayer, I don't remember if you had this quote in or not from Letters to Malcolm.
If it was a good one, I have it in there.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Lewis wrote, our prayers are granted or not in eternity. Our prayers and other free acts are known to us only as we come to the moment of doing them, the present, right? That's our moment of dealing with that prayer. But they are eternally in the score of the great symphony. Not predetermined, the syllable pre lets in the notion of eternity as simply an older time. For though we cannot experience our life as an endless present, we are eternal in God's eyes, that is, in our deepest reality.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, as you
well, and talking about prayer, I think about, you know, that just triggered a memory for me of sitting with my daughter. She's 2 years old, going to sleep. And she would make sure that I would stay in the room until she fell asleep. And I was manipulated because I was a first, you know, as my first child. So I did whatever she wanted me to do. So I'm sitting there and I'm praying for her, and I'm praying for her future. I'm doing the work of praying that actually will impact time 10, 20 years later. And I had a great conversation recently with my middle daughter. Something good happened. She got a job and she's like, you know, but I wasn't praying for that. I said, honey, I've been praying for that for 20 years. I've been praying for that and 12 other things at least. And you think, well, I didn't do it this week. I didn't pray that this week, so therefore it's not. No, no, there's been prayers going on forever. My grandmother, you know, she was praying for me every day. You're telling me that doesn't have an impact? It has a huge impact. It just doesn't have the impact when she's doing it. Her present was not where the prayer was happening. Or no, the prayer was happening in her present. The impact of the prayer wasn't happening. It was going to happen. And if we think about God being out of time, the prayer actually was activated on by God before time began. And so I think when we talk about prayer, we're talking to someone who can make change that is outside of time. And we depend on that. I mean, basically the whole thing hinges on that, that God is outside of time. He's the maker of time. He created all these things, and he actually can do change in ways that we can't even fathom because we're locked into to 60 seconds.
Yeah, yeah, well said. Well, and then so many of the ways that we screw things up for ourselves as far as ingratitude towards God come back to this, that we could make life so much easier on ourselves if we can learn to process our prayers this way and answers to prayers in this way, as opposed to, well, I said I wanted it. Why isn't it here now? Like, right, as though we either had a right to it or had a right to it in our time, as though we know what the best time is.
Well, and how many times have you prayed something and then, you know, it doesn't happen? And then you realize, oh, that would have been horrible mm-hmm. if that happened. But at the moment, we're saying, well, you have to answer the prayer just the way I want it to.
This is a fun subplot in a couple of the, I think both David Tennant and Nat Smith have stretches with this, where they experience time in the way that God does in that respect. So they'll, you know, hey, I'll come back in 2 years and I'll be right here. And that would be the right time. But because they're not God, they lose track
right,
of time
right.
in their own way.
Oh, yeah. Matt Smith comes back. Amy Pond is like, I've been waiting. You said you'd be right back. For Matt Smith, it was right back. For Amy, she comes, you know, he comes back.
Because he didn't have her chronological concept. Yeah. Because,
yeah.
And she's grown up because he doesn't have her perspective of
right.
the appropriate moment, nor does he have God's perspective right. of Kairos.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So we're about out of time, but we can't finish the conversation without having the best doctor discussion, at least for a minute.
It's true. It's true. What kind of nerd would I be if I couldn't defend that? And with my family, we all have our own special doctors that we fight over. And my one daughter, she has been watching this series with one of her friends, and they argue constantly because they have different great doctors. They argue between Capaldi and Smith. For me, I just loved Peter Davidson. And I think it was the cricket jacket. Also, he was, you know, he's running around with his trainers and his hat. I loved him very much. Like I said, Pertwee was my first. And when David Tennant and Peter Davidson hit, there's a thing called Time Crash. It was like a mini episode. I couldn't tell you how happy I was because you had both of my favorite doctors. I guess I've just answered your question. You have both of my favorite doctors meeting and talking to each other, and David Tennant saying, well, you were always my doctor. And the fact that David Tennant is married to Peter Davidson's daughter, but she's also in the series, his daughter, that's just too beautiful. I think that, like I said earlier, I think Matt Smith was?
Peter Capaldi.
Capaldi. I think Capaldi could have been the best. I don't think he was given the good scripts. I would say this about Timothy Dalton. He would have been a really good James Bond. Wasn't given good scripts. So I think Tennant is probably the best, if not the best. Except that I love Peter Davidson so much. But Matt Smith has the Ponds. And they are like probably the best traveling companions. All right, so there I've laid out. That's a completely... There's a lot you can poke your holes in and fight on.
So for me,
Do we base it on outfits? Do we base it on catchphrases?
Do you base it just on the writing?
I feel like it's an injustice to Capaldi to evaluate him based on the stories. Mm-hmm. But that's what we have.
So here's the fun thing for me. I didn't grow up with classic Doctor Who, so I don't have the nostalgia temptation with any of those. And I find the campy plots and special effects really distracting.
Really campy.
And so my brain goes straight to the post, the 2005 reboot.
Eccleston.
And what I liked about the Eccleston, Tennant, Smith, Capaldi stretch was... kind of like you and I were talking about Sherlock Holmes last night, which probably also should have been an episode.
Oh my goodness, yes.
The character is complex enough that usually an actor is going to do one aspect of, or maybe at best two aspects of the character particularly well. So in the case of Sherlock Holmes, you have like Benedict Cumberbatch, who doesn't, he does the high functioning sociopath part of Sherlock Holmes. He doesn't do the king and country, right and wrong, showing mercy, kind of the good side of him. With Doctor Who, my favorite thing about the character in the abstract is the line that he walks, the pull that he feels in two different directions. The one being the intense grief and anger over all of the wrong that he's seen, especially in his own personal history, with also a superhuman sense of wonder at the ordinary. That's one of the reasons that he loves humans so much.
Which makes him exceptional in as a Gallifreyan. Because the other ones don't seem to have that. They don't have the wonder.
Yeah. Whereas, you know,
they just have the time lord rather than the time traveler aspect of them.
So they reboot it with Capaldi. And one of the best things about Capaldi, you know, he's got that episode where he runs into the Dalek and he's just, you get to see the rage that he has at this enemy race that has destroyed so much. But on the other hand, he runs through the whole season going, that's fantastic.
Right. That's Eccleston. You said Capaldi. But
I meant Eccleston. Yeah, sorry.
I'm sure you did. I just wanted, for their listeners.
Exactly. And then you sort of vault over a couple doctors later to Matt Smith. He gets the that's fantastic side of it really, really well.
Oh, yeah. I don't think he does the sadness of Eccleston as well. Like, Eccleston is carrying the weight of the time war in his heart.
This is why I think that actually Smith, to me, I really enjoyed those seasons.
Oh, yeah.
Partly because of the Pawns. I agree with you. I think Smith is the most terrifying doctor because he's the one who's sort of forgotten the grief. He's forgotten.
He's unmoored in that way.
With the result that he makes some crazy decisions that smash time pretty significantly. And then Capaldi goes on to do some of the same. Like, I have this power. I'm going to use it. So my favorite doctor, like most people, is David Tennant because he did both so well. He got the depths of the grief and anger, but you got to see more of like Eccleston. It was just, that's fantastic. Tennant showed you why he thought it was fantastic, why he loved humanity so much, why he loved thought ordinary things were so beautiful. And to have accomplished the depths of both of those aspects of the character in one actor, I think was remarkable.
Yeah, he is actually the best of both worlds between Eccleston and Smith. Because he does have the gravitas of Eccleston. He does have the mirth without the fez of Smith. And he does, he does that range. And I would say we are in agreement. And he's got a great suit. And he's got pockets. And he has things that he pulls out of pockets. But even his run, there were clunkers.
Oh, yeah. Very silly episodes.
Oh, my goodness. That just so painful. I'm not even going to acknowledge I ever watched that episode.
And the special effects budget bump from Tennant to Smith was so noticeable.
Right.
Now I'm watching modern television in the best sense of the word.
Yeah.
Which is always funny when
you talk about time, too.
Yeah.
One of the things that was interesting about one of the better characters, at least initially, you talked about Blink. The villain is someone that can take you out of time.
Yeah.
And robs you of your time and of your future. And that's how it gets its power. It's an amazing idea that I wish poor Tennant could have gotten to battle. But, oh, wait. Did he, though? Don't Blink. So he did deal with them.
But it was kind of a standalone adventure. He was barely in it.
Yeah.
Matt Smith got to do a lot more with those villains.
But see, I think in the Matt Smith, they overdid the angels who have the phone box.
Kind of like
for those who are
new Jurassic World movies, show the monsters too much.
Yeah, yeah.
Lose the mystery.
You don't understand what really scary is. If showing me the monster, you don't understand fear. Yeah, and for those who are listening who don't know Doctor Who at all, I'm sorry. This was all very fascinating, and you're really not able to enjoy the fullness of it.
But yes, go find the Blink episode and try that and see if it doesn't suck you in. Well, we're out of time.
Are we?
We are.
Are we?
I know.
It's time. We have plenty of time. all eternity. Thank you for giving me this time to talk about this, though. I just revel in this, and yeah, we could do 12 more episodes, and I'd be happy.
Yeah, we totally could. Well, and for those of you listening, head over to ImaginationRedeemed.com and sign up for the conference, because we'll be spending the whole weekend talking about time. Some of it will be very theological and abstract. Much of it will be very, very practical in terms of how we spend our days, how we find our identities type questions. And we may or may not do some kind of interactive Doctor Who session, because that would be pretty fun.
It would be fantastic.
It would be fantastic. All right. And we'll see you all next time.